The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues for the next half hour. I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Heart Letter. This is the March 2025 Harvard Heart Letter, and the first article is called Shining a Light on the Diabetes Heart Disease Connection. If you have diabetes, you're twice as likely to have a heart attack or stroke than someone without diabetes, even if you keep your blood sugar under control most of the time. In fact, recent research suggests this elevated cardiovascular risk is present as early as 30 years prior to a diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. Typically diagnosed after age 45, type 2 diabetes accounts for more than 90% of diabetes cases in the United States. The new findings support the long-held observation of the shared underlying causes of diabetes and heart disease, says Dr. Deborah Wexler, chief of the diabetes unit at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. It's known as the common soil hypothesis, which dates back to the mid-1990s, she says. The soil refers to risk factors that contribute to both conditions, especially a tendency to accumulate fat in the middle of the body. Also known as visceral or abdominal obesity, this problem typically occurs in tandem with high blood pressure, unhealthy lipid levels, and elevated blood sugar. This cluster of signs and symptoms is also known as metabolic syndrome. In type 2 diabetes, the body is often resistant to insulin, the hormone made by the pancreas that enables cells throughout the body to absorb glucose for energy. As a result, muscle, fat, and liver cells can't easily absorb glucose from the blood, causing blood sugar levels to rise. In response, the pancreas tries to keep up with the demand by churning out more insulin. But over time, the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas falter, leading to prediabetes and eventually diabetes. Belly fat, which makes hormones and other substances that trigger chronic inflammation, is a common hallmark of insulin resistance. Another is physical inactivity. Exercise makes your body more sensitive to insulin and builds muscle which absorbs blood glucose. While a poor diet and being sedentary clearly contribute to diabetes, genetic factors play a role as well. Having one parent with diabetes translates to a 40% lifetime risk of the disease. If both parents are affected, the risk rises to 70%, according to some estimates. Still, people with a high genetic risk can prevent diabetes with healthy habits, says Dr. Wexler. In a study that included identical twins at risk, the twin who maintained a healthy weight did not get diabetes, but the one who gained weight did, she says. The 2025 Standards of Care in Diabetes from the American Diabetes Association includes several updates targeted to lifestyle changes for people with diabetes, such as a recommendation to do strength training 2 to 3 times per week, like lifting weights or using resistance bands. The benefits include preventing muscle loss and improving insulin sensitivity and overall metabolism. One diet-related tip encourages drinking water instead of beverages sweetened with sugar. Another is a recommendation to eat more plant-based protein and fiber, a common refrain for heart-healthy eating. People with diabetes tend to focus on keeping their blood sugar values in the normal range. That's important because uncontrolled high blood sugar can damage tiny blood vessels throughout the body, causing vision problems, nerve damage, and kidney disease. But most people don't realize the leading cause of death in diabetes is cardiovascular disease, says Dr. Wexler. Doctors have long encouraged aggressive treatment of heart-related risk factors for people with diabetes. keeping blood pressure and cholesterol levels in a healthy range, and quitting smoking. Over the past decade, two new classes of drugs, SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 receptor agonists, have emerged that not only lower blood sugar, but also reduce heart-related risks. Major medical societies, including the American College of Cardiology, recommend these drugs in people with type 2 diabetes who either have or are at high risk of heart disease, regardless of their A1C level. The A1C test, commonly used for monitoring diabetes, provides a 3-month average measure of blood sugar. Levels of 6.5 or higher are classified as diabetes. Both classes of medication are underused, although the use of GLP-1 drugs, especially semaglutide, in people with diabetes has risen in recent years. Taken weekly by self-injection, semaglutide and tirzepatide can lead to dramatic weight loss, although they may cause nausea and can be expensive, even with insurance coverage. Both drugs are prescribed in different formulations for weight loss, semaglutide under the name Wegovy and tirzepatide under the name Zepbound. Cardiologists and nephrologists may be more comfortable prescribing SGLT2 inhibitors, which are taken in pill form and have been around for more than a decade. Both semaglutide and SGLT2 inhibitors have kidney benefits for people with chronic kidney disease. If you have diabetes, ask your physician whether you should add one of these drugs to your current medication regimen. If you don't, follow your physician's advice regarding when and how often you should be screened for diabetes. For people who are overweight, the latest guidelines suggest screening every 3 years, starting at age 35. The article goes on to mention that SGLT2 inhibitors include Invokana, Farxiga, and Jardiance. Taken in pill form, they cause the kidneys to release more sugar into the urine. This lowers the blood sugar and also dumps excess calories, leading to modest weight loss and a little bit lower blood pressure. Then the GLP-1 receptor agonists include Trulicity, Victoza, Ozempic, and Mounjaro. These injectable medications mimic a naturally occurring hormone that prods your pancreas to release more insulin. Tirzepatide, which mimics both GLP-1 and another hormone called GIP, works in a similar fashion. Studies of tirzepatide's cardiovascular effects are in process, but one study showed tirzepatide was beneficial for people with obesity and a common form of heart failure. Now, as we continue the Harvard Heart Letter, we're going to turn to a section called Ask the Doctor by Dr. Christopher Cannon, who is the editor-in-chief. And here's the question. Since getting a stent last year, I've been taking aspirin and clopidogrel. Lately, I've started getting minor bruises on my limbs. At my 1-year follow-up, my cardiologist said I can stop the aspirin. Is that safe? Yes, it's safe. Stopping aspirin a year after receiving a stent recently became standard practice, says Dr. Cannon. In fact, it actually may be safer than the previously recommended practice of stopping the clopidogrel rather than the aspirin. When people receive stents, doctors routinely prescribe aspirin along with another medication that prevents clots. These drugs include clopidogrel or Plavix, prasugrel or Effient, and ticagrelor or Brilinta. Like aspirin, they prevent blood components called platelets from sticking together and forming clots. The formation of clots inside the stent, known as stent thrombosis, can lead to a heart attack. The combination of aspirin and one of those stronger antiplatelet drugs is called dual antiplatelet therapy. The question of how long people should stay on dual antiplatelet therapy has been a matter of debate for years. For people who get a stent for a heart attack, current guidelines suggest at least 1 year, and sometimes longer for those at high risk. But that assumes they don't develop any major bleeding complications, the main side effects of DAPT. Major bleeding includes heavy bleeding from the stomach, intestines, or bladder. Sometimes severe nosebleeds can also occur. People who develop major bleeding may need to stop taking the drugs sooner. Rarely, bleeding occurs in the brain, a potentially debilitating or even fatal complication. Any of these episodes will lead your doctor to consider shortening the duration of DAPT. The bruising you're experiencing on your limbs is a sign of minor bleeding and will likely improve once you stop taking aspirin. Aspirin can provoke bleeding in the stomach and intestines because it inhibits substances called prostaglandins that protect the stomach's delicate lining. Proton pump inhibitors like non-prescription omeprazole, Prilosec, or prescription-only pantoprazole, Protonix, may help reduce the risk of gastrointestinal bleeding. Clopidogrel and other drugs do not affect prostaglandins and therefore pose a lower risk of bleeding from the stomach. In several large trials, people on a dual antiplatelet therapy following a heart attack or stent placement were switched to either aspirin alone or to clopidogrel or ticagrelor alone. All groups had equal protection against recurrent heart attack, stroke, or stent thrombosis. But those taking clopidogrel or ticagrelor alone had lower rates of bleeding. As such, stopping aspirin is becoming the new approach to long-term antiplatelet treatment after the first year of DAPT. So rest assured, your doctor's advice makes good sense. Now the next article is called Seeding Doubt, the Truth About Cooking Oils. And the article goes on to say, bogus information about seed oils, especially canola oil and soybean oil, has been circulating on the internet for a decade. The details are misleading, often creating confusion in the kitchen. Patients ask me if they need to avoid seed oils because they've seen social media claim that these oils are toxic and can promote all sorts of diseases, says Allison Kane, a dietitian at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. But these oils aren't inherently unhealthy. It all depends on how you use them. That is, combined with which specific types of food and how much you're consuming. Edible oils derived from plants are commonly called cooking or vegetable oils. They include seed oils, which are extracted from the seeds of different plants, and include canola, corn, soybean, sunflower, and safflower oils. Seed oils contain mostly unsaturated fat, while fats from animal sources like butter, cheese, and meat contain mostly saturated fat. Decades of research show that consuming unsaturated fat in place of saturated fat is linked to a lower risk of heart attack and death. Seed oils have other attributes. For example, canola oil is a decent source of ALA, alpha-linolenic acid, the main vegetarian source of essential omega-3 fatty acids. Like EPA and DHA, the omega-3 fats found in fatty fish, ALA has anti-inflammatory and other effects thought to benefit cardiovascular health. Canola oil also contains phytosterols, which are compounds that occur naturally in plants that may help lower cholesterol. According to the critics, seed oils also have certain unsavory attributes. After seeds are crushed, their oil is extracted with hexane, a solvent that's hazardous in gas form, but evaporates during oil processing, leaving limited, if any, residual hexane in the liquid form. Seed oils contain omega-6 fatty acids, including linoleic acid. Our body converts linoleic acid into arachidonic acid, a building block for molecules that promote inflammation. Chronic inflammation plays a role in heart disease. Finally, soybean and canola oils are commonly used in fast foods and other restaurant and prepared foods because they're inexpensive. Repeatedly heating unsaturated oils up to high temperatures creates trans fats and other harmful substances. Factories and restaurants don't change their oil often enough to get rid of those compounds, which contributes to the strong link between fried food and heart disease. The claims against seed oil deserve a second look. Regarding hexane, the average person's intake of any possible residual traces of this chemical in oils and other foods is dwarfed by exposures from other sources like gasoline fumes. What's more, the dangerous compounds of heated seed oils in fast food are just one aspect of deep-fried fast foods like fries and chicken fingers. These foods also contain high amounts of fat, added sugars, salt, and calories. That's also true of other common calorie sources in the average American diet. Seed oils are hiding in our food supply, mainly in crunchy, salty, or sweet snack foods that come in a bag like chips, crackers, cookies, and other baked goods, Kane says. Finally, the linoleic concerns aren't backed by science. Research shows that increased linoleic acid in the diet does not increase levels of inflammatory markers in the blood. Kane said there's no need to worry about those bottles of soybean, canola, and sunflower oils in your pantry. Using a few tablespoons to saute vegetables or in a salad dressing is a healthy option. You can also replace all or part of the butter or margarine with canola or another mild-flavored seed oil in recipes for baked goods like muffins and cakes. It's best to store seed oils in the refrigerator to preserve their flavor and freshness. Eating lots of fast food and junk food is a real problem. However, Kane tells her patients it's fine to enjoy fun foods like French fries and other treats once in a while. The key is to consume seed oils and all other sources of fat in moderation. Now here's another useful article about lipoprotein A, an update on testing and treatment. New therapies for elevated lipoprotein A, an inherited cause of early heart disease, are in the pipeline. A fatty particle that circulates in the bloodstream, lipoprotein A is similar to LDL cholesterol, but more dangerous. High levels of lipoprotein A, as it's commonly caused, can double or even triple a person's risk of heart attack. It's considered a common culprit in heart disease that occurs at a young age. So why do so few people know about it? Until recently, most guidelines didn't recommend testing for lipoprotein A, but with good reason. Your genes determine your lipoprotein A value. Eating and exercise habits have virtually no effect on the levels in your bloodstream. There are no effective treatments to lower lipoprotein A, which also elevates the risk of stroke and aortic stenosis. Now, new promising therapies to lower lipoprotein A are in development, and the landscape is changing. Here is the latest advice. International consensus groups recommend one-time lipoprotein A testing for everyone. In Europe, such testing is routine. But in the United States, the first official endorsement for lipoprotein A testing didn't appear until 2024. Recent data shows that only 0.3% of people received lipoprotein A screening between 2012 and 2019, says Harvard Medical School Associate Professor Dr. Michelle O'Donohue. Also, about half of those tests were ordered by a very small number of healthcare providers. But lipoprotein A testing should soon become more widespread, for several reasons. First, the tests are now covered by most insurers. Secondly, even though targeted therapy to lower lipoprotein A are not yet on the market, people with high levels may benefit from more intensive treatment to manage their overall risk of heart disease. This may include taking cholesterol-lowering drugs like statins, even if your LDL cholesterol is normal. Low-dose aspirin is also being investigated as a possible therapy for preventing heart attack in people with high lipoprotein A. Unlike LDL, which rises with age and is influenced by diet and exercise, lipoprotein A remains largely constant over a person's lifetime, so a one-time test suffices for screening. However, researchers are working to better understand changes that may occur in lipoprotein A in women around the time of menopause and for men and women with certain medical conditions. The following groups of people are specifically recommended for testing: people with premature cardiovascular disease, people who have a father, mother, sister, or brother with premature cardiovascular disease, people with a very high LDL cholesterol, 190 or higher, and close relatives of anyone with an elevated lipoprotein A level. What about therapies? Most of the drugs in development for lowering lipoprotein A work by interfering with RNA, the molecule that copies and transfers genetic instructions from DNA, the cell's genetic blueprint. Currently, there are four RNA-based drugs that effectively silence the gene that makes lipoprotein A in liver cells. They are called lepodisiran, olpasiran, pelacarsin, and zerlasiran. All are administered by injection every 1 to 6 months and have been shown to lower lipoprotein A by 80 to 100%. The side effects are mild, short-lived pain at the injection site. Larger, longer trials looking at whether these drugs will help prevent heart-related problems are currently underway, with results expected in 1 to 2 years, says Dr. O'Donohue, who's a lead investigator on the clinical trial of olpasiran. Preliminary results also look promising for another experimental drug called muvalaplin, which works by preventing the assembly of lipoprotein A particles. Like the RNA-based drugs, muvalaplin also leads to a dramatic drop in lipoprotein A, but is taken as a daily pill. Side effects, including headache, back pain, and fatigue, occur. While some people prefer pills over shots, injectable drugs have the advantage of much less frequent dosing, Dr. O'Donohue notes. Now here's a brief article from Research We're Watching, again from the March 2025 issue of Harvard Heart Letter. And it says, a daily dose of dark chocolate lowers diabetes risk. New research finds that people with a habit of eating dark chocolate, about an ounce a day, were less likely to develop diabetes compared to those who didn't consume it. For the study, researchers analyzed dietary questionnaire responses and health records from 192,000 people who were followed for 30 years. After accounting for the participants' age, exercise levels, and other factors, they found that those who ate 5 ounces of dark chocolate per week had a 21% lower chance of developing diabetes compared with those who rarely or never ate dark chocolate. Those who ate milk chocolate weren't protected against diabetes. In fact, they were more likely to gain weight. Observational studies like these can't prove a certain food confers a health benefit. But compared to milk chocolate, dark chocolate has less sugar and much higher levels of flavonoids, which studies suggest may improve blood sugar regulation, possibly guarding against diabetes. Another brief article says that there's no cognitive effects after years of very low LDL cholesterol. Having an extremely low LDL level from aggressive cholesterol-lowering therapy was not associated with cognitive impairment, according to a new study. The study was an extension of an earlier investigation of people with heart disease that compared the cognitive effects of taking the cholesterol-lowering drug Repatha plus a statin to taking a statin alone. The study found no difference in cognitive function between the two groups after a median follow-up of 19 months. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.